Susan, Butcher Box to the rescue. The other night we had some friends over for dinner and we had no idea what to make. And I was like, guess what? We have a freezer full of meat. So my husband went down and thawed out some chicken from Butcher Box and made the best coq au vin that we've had in a long, long time.
Yeah, you'd have been screwed without Butcher Box because I know you ain't got no time to go to the store right now.
That's true. I don't have time to go shop for meat or pick out the meat or find the best quality, low-priced meat. So ButcherBox does all of that for me.
So, true story, my husband's workplace has a Slack channel called Smoked Meats. And I know you can't like win a workplace conversation, but he is now because with Butcher Box, his great cuts of meat to the door, they can cook up and take photos of for his workmates.
I love ButcherBox, and I think other people would too.
ButcherBox is the ultimate convenience, delivered right to your doorstep, free shipping always, with curated, customized box plans.
It's 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork, raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood.
There are a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value with exclusive membership deals. They also provide recipe inspiration, guides, tips, and hacks.
Sign up at butcherbox.com/proof and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off.
Choose salmon, chicken breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/proof and use code PROOF to choose your free for a year offer. Plus, get $20 off your first order. If you're listening to this show, then I'm going to guess you're a fan of true crime podcasts. So in the mornings, grab your favorite mug and pour yourself a dose of spine-tingling true crime every AM with Morning Cup of Murder. It's a short daily show that's the perfect podcast to incorporate into your morning routine. In less than 15 minutes, you'll hear about a true crime that took place on today's date in history. Each day's dark history lesson will kickstart your morning with intriguing tales of murder, abduction, serial killers, cults, and more.
So, pour yourself a piping hot cup of murder every single morning with Morning Cup of Murder. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to this week's Sidebar. We're here to discuss episode 8 of season 2 of Proof. I'm here with Jacinda and Kevin, and we're going to talk about all things Manteca. Hey, guys.
Hey, Susan.
Hey, Susan.
So, if you were a teenager in Manteca in 2000, what social group would you have been in?
You know, it's so funny you asked that because I was thinking about it yesterday. I totally would have been like hanging out with the goth skaters in the
You'd have been Grim Crew.
corner. I don't know if I would have been Grim Crew, but I would have been like eyeing Grim Crew, and I would have been the girl that no one is talking to.
A Grim Crew groupie.
Yes.
I don't know what group I would have been because, I'm not really a skateboarder, but I will say that I instantly thought Jacinda would have been hanging out with this group. That's where my mind went. I could see her on the side of the skate park with like dark nails, brooding.
I mean, her clothing colors already fit in for them.
Yeah, I mean, right. She wouldn't even have to go shopping again.
More leather and spikes, probably, but other than that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You're being mean to me, but it's not like I have anything I can say to refute what you're saying.
We're not being mean. We're just making observations.
Right, I'll take that.
Well, this episode, we find out about Grim Crew and hear the reality of what they were. And the more of the Grim Crew guys I talk to, I just a lot of them found out for the first time from me about what I said at trial. And they were upset. And they're like, oh, that's why everyone hated us after this trial. Like most of them didn't know that they had been accused collectively as being the ones organizing this party at the Home Depot.
Yeah, they had no idea what the story was at trial. So they had no idea what was being said about them or Grim Crew in general. And I do think we surprised a lot of people when we told them that they had helped orchestrate a murder.
It's another example I find so interesting in this case. It was right around the time before the world exploded with the internet and all this information. So all of these people don't know all of these things that if the case were happening now, that they would.
But
And
people at the court did hear it. So they hated Grim Crew because of this.
right.
So even if they didn't understand why they were getting all this anger directed towards them, they felt it.
Right. It's a snapshot in time, and that's for sure.
And Jake was, I mean, trying to say who was in Grim Crew. It's basically just, a collection of the misfits. Jake was definitely part of that collective group. Shocker, the guy in prison who like risked himself to save bats and tarantulas was actually a little goth kid.
Yeah, it seems though that maybe he floated in between groups more than some of the others, right?
He did.
He was associated with Grim Crew, but he also would skate with some of the better skaters like Chris and, hang out with Fuji. So his circle was wider.
Yeah. Also, it's interesting what we learned about Jake as a skater while in Manteca. In fact, here is a conversation we had with Jake after we talked to some of his former friends, and in particular, what his friend Chris had to say about him. Chris said that you were not that good a skater, though.
Motherfucker. He out of everybody that we that was our like little crew, he was probably the best.
We also heard this episode from two of Jake's friends, Chris and Lewis, who were definitely not at all Grim Crew. However, at trial, the prosecutor defends them both as Grim Crew members to explain why their testimony didn't support the state's case. And in Lewis's case, why he recanted and said he had not told detectives the truth and that they pressured him into saying things about Jake that were not true. And basically, Grim Crew was the boogeyman in this case. Like anytime at Jake's trial, something didn't go right, Prosecutor Schultz was like, oh, it's Grim Crew. Grim Crew is behind this.
Meaning that he would say the reason why they're testifying this way is because they're scared of Grim Crew. They're scared of re retaliation.
Or because they're big bad Grim Crew members. And because of that, they're just fucking up everything and like being hostile and lying.
And there was no way for the defense to prove otherwise.
I mean, it's a hard thing to combat. They do try a little bit, but the thing is, they're saying all Grim Crew people are like lying bad kids. So having one of these lying bad kids try and refute it, the prosecutor's just going to say, no, they're lying because that's what Grim Crew does.
Good storytelling, right? Like you set out the storyline and the bad characters, and you let the rest take care of itself.
I mean, it's sort of like brilliant in a way that the prosecutor came up with this idea to present information this way, because you're right, no matter what the truth is, he can fall back on this story of, well, they're lying because of Grim Crew.
Yep, and this case has a lot of problems with recanting witnesses and witnesses who don't support the narrative. And this is sort of the way he rebuts all of that. And it's also interesting, too, that we mentioned before, like at Ty's trial, this doesn't come up. At Ty's trial, they don't have these teenagers testifying. So the whole Grim Crew thing isn't present. Instead, what the prosecutor claims is that Josh lies because he's scared of Ty, not because of Grim Crew. He's scared of Ty.
Right. And if you remember, he uses that when Ty spoke out in court when Josh walked by, like, I think he said, "You lying motherfucker." And it was twisted to him saying, "I'm going to get you."
You're going down, punk.
I always find it incredibly interesting when you have two people on trial and the theories presented by the prosecution for a crime are different when the trial is separate, right? Like when you have separated trials and they take a different approach with each, it always stands out to me.
And then we also heard more this episode about Josh Burrows himself and how, like, where he fell sort of in the social hierarchy. And he was young, he was 14. He was one of the youngest ones hanging around this group. And he was not really deeply embedded in the group. Like, he was a friend to some of them, he hung around them, but he was this little kid who was kind of weird, is kind of the general consensus from everyone we talked to.
He's this young kid trying to fit in. He doesn't really fit in. They sort of tolerate him, let him hang out, but not any real sort of friendship there.
We mentioned the weird stories or the tall tales. I mean, the things that Josh would say were so weird that people were kind of uncomfortable with him. Like, he'd go around claiming to be like a gun smuggler or a vampire.
The vampire one to me seems like it makes you realize just how young he is too, right?
Yeah, like he was just a little kid claiming to be a vampire because he thought it made him look cool.
Yeah, he's desperate for friends.
We talked to Fuji in this episode, and we talked to him about how much this case has affected him and to this day. But one of the things he says about Burroughs is no hard feelings. He was just a scared little kid. And I found that pretty remarkable that Fuji has sympathy or empathy for Josh, even though what he said has affected Fuji so much.
Although when we showed him the video of Josh's statements, you could see him getting worked up again in that moment. I mean, for him, that was all new. He'd never seen what Josh actually said. And watching it, he was just like, Jesus, that really this is what did it to me? Like this thing, this story?
Yeah, he clearly got worked up when he showed him that. I hear you just in that. I think he sort of went back in his mind to just how awful he felt when all of this was coming down on him, when people were pointing the finger at Fuji. And I think he had this sort of moment when we were there where he was remembering how it all kind of spiraled out of control very quickly. And, it started becoming more than just what Josh said. It just started becoming this wave. Fuji still carries it around. You can see it. And I think he just wants it to be over.
Well, he carries it around because people around him still think that he was involved in some way.
Yeah, that's true. And I think he realized this at some point that there was no way to fight that.
Without addressing it head on.
Yeah. And so I think that's definitely impacted his life. I mean, we all know that.
Yeah, I mean, they were looking very closely at him, and he didn't realize how close he came to being charged until we spoke to him.
And we don't know exactly why they didn't charge him. I think it's like sort of a combination of factors, and that the most direct evidence they had against Fuji didn't even come from Josh Burroughs. Later on, they had some statements from people like Ryan Kerr and Troy Tulin, the ones who recanted at trial, who basically made Fuji Jake's right-hand man for the story. But I think just it was a harder case to bring. But they could have done it. And I honestly think if the timing had been different and the way that evidence developed, they would have charged him.
And just to be clear, that doesn't mean there is any actual evidence
No. No,
pointing
not at all.
Fuji.
Fuji will always, in my mind, represent kind of this. When we met him, when I got to talking to him, and it clearly damaged him and it had altered the course of his life. And then when we saw the photos, his mugshots of that time, you realize what another life ago this was and how it had sort of drastically altered the course of his and everyone else's life because he was a kid. And you could see it in his face. I mean, Jake was a kid. He looks a little sort of harder and more developed in his pictures. Like this was a kid. Fuji was a kid. There was something about seeing that photograph that triggered something in my head when I first saw it.
Yeah, you get to see like just how much it changed his life to see this like innocent little kid in this mugshot. I mean, I remember when we first came across this, Susan, I was like, who is this? Like, I didn't even recognize him. And I think people, you know, are quick to judge, like, you know, Fuji was reluctant to talk to us. And it's not because he's guilty of anything, it's because it's hurt him so much. Why would he want to talk about it? Why would he want to bring it up? And a lot of people in this case assumed, you know, we talked earlier about no internet and, you know, there was no way for them to check it, to fact check it. Everyone assumed that they found evidence and that Jake and Ty were convicted because they were guilty.
I mean, even Fuji, who knows he's been falsely accused of this, even he just instantly accepted the idea that Jake and Ty were being legitimately accused.
Yeah, exactly. In the episode, you hear Fuji say something about, I wasn't that worried because I wasn't there. I knew I didn't do it. And, you know, in my head, I was thinking, well, Jake thought the same thing, and look how it turned out for him, right? I don't think any of these kids were really that worried that they could end up serving life in prison because they all knew they didn't do it.
It's also strange, too, who the police ended up going with as party attendees. To me, it is wild that they never ever talked to Jake's friend Chris. Because Chris, like we said in the show, like had the party been real, he would have been there. So would his friend Lewis. And those are the two who show up publicly with Jake at the funeral. So there's no secret these two are close to him, they're standing by him, they got his back still. And yet they're never considered as like possible party attendees. If they seriously believed in this Home Depot party story, that's who they would have looked at.
Yeah, I guess you could argue, though, Susan, you could say, well, in a world where there is a party, if the party was organized so that there'd be a chance to rape and kill Renee, maybe they wouldn't invite their best friends because probably they would have stopped it. So you could make that argument.
They're going to invite a bunch of like 15-year-old girls instead. Going to invite Josh Burroughs.
But seriously, I mean, you could make an argument that they wouldn't invite the people who they thought would not be cool with what they had planned. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm
Yeah.
in a world where that could be an argument.
They don't even seem to think about it, though. Like I said, they never even talked to Chris. And Chris was with Jake for a lot of that week.
The case always comes back to me to the fact that nobody we've ever spoken to can say that there was party. So Chris is one of the most crystal examples of it. And I can remember when we were sitting there talking to him about it. I mean, nobody else was at this party that is the basis for the prosecution theory of what happened. Not a soul. And that's what I always come back to. And Chris is one of the prime examples of that. And watching his face while he's trying to piece together when we're talking to him that he wasn't invited to this party and like he doesn't know anything about it.
Yeah, he never doubted it. He never doubted the party story. But then as he's talking, he's like, wait, I would have been there.
And so it's this thing that's sort of clicking for everyone. You know, I mean, we've all said this over and over again. Like everybody believed the story, but nobody ever sat down to think about it or heard all the details about it. He very likely would have been at the party had there been.
Hey everyone, before we continue with this episode, I want to tell you about another podcast. Have you ever wondered what it feels like to watch your house burn down or be attacked by an alligator or learn that your spouse hired someone to kill you? If you're dying to know, then What Was That Like is the podcast for you. What Was That Like is filled with real stories about the most surreal experiences of people's lives. On the show, host Scott Johnson dives deep with his guests into the unbelievable situations they found themselves in, like animal attacks, plane crashes, winning The Price is Right, and more. The show brings you tons of completely surreal, completely true stories, all told through the lens of the person who actually experienced it.
Check out some of these episodes about wild and gripping stories to gain some insight on what it was like to, say, be a professional bridesmaid or lose a leg in a shark attack.
Susan, I think you'd be a really good professional bridesmaid.
And you'd be really good at losing a leg in a shark attack.
Oh, gee, thanks.
So if you want to hear some disturbing and inspiring firsthand stories, you need to check out What Was That Like? Every story is thoroughly researched and fact-checked, so you know even the most bizarre tales are someone's reality. Listen to What Was That Like on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Every Town Podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. And we give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. Cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists. So go check out the Every Town podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
We also, while in Antica, got to talk to a lot of like Jake's Renee's friends and sort of help flesh out more of the timeline in this case. And when you first look at the case file, there's no like established timeline. Everything is, you know, jumbled witness statements, kids who don't know when stuff happened. But when you look at all the statements as a whole and sort of interlock them together and say, okay, this witness was at this house this night, that must have been on Tuesday because so-and-so was there whatever day. It's sort of slow going, but once you piece it together, like you actually can get a pretty good timeline of what happened that week and where people were, what was going on. But the thing that's most clear to me is that that whole week after Monday morning, there's just no way Jake and Renee were hanging out together in public. Someone would have been with them. Someone would have talked to them and hung out with them. And no one saw her with him that time.
Yeah, no one saw Jake and Renee together that we know of after Monday morning at Labor Ready.
Jake was hanging out with a lot of people. Like he was, all he did was like hang with friends and skate all day. He's not like sitting alone in a room somewhere. He is out and about with people everywhere. And if Renee had been with him, someone would have seen it.
And the other thing, the people he is hanging out with all say Jake was talking about how he couldn't find Renee.
He was looking for her. And none of them, I don't think one person that we've spoken to remembers being particularly worried. Basically, everyone knew that Renee's family and friends like hated Jake. So for them, it made perfect sense that Renee was with them somewhere and no one's going to talk to Jake about it because they don't like him anyway.
Right, because Renee's close friends, like her girlfriends, some of who you hear in the podcast, they didn't hang out with like Jake's friends.
Yeah.
So Jake is saying, I can't find Renee. And his friends are like, oh, she's probably with her friends. You know, she's probably just took off for a couple of days. She doesn't want to be with you. And it makes sense because those worlds wouldn't have overlapped.
So give a quick run through of what we know about the timelines in this case. Things are pretty sketchy because, again, the kids are just hanging out skating most of the time. But what we know of that week is that Monday afternoon is when Jake first starts looking for Renee. He goes to Fuji's. He goes to places they usually hang out. He goes to Labor Ready. She's not there anywhere. Monday night, so the night that first night that Renee is missing, we know that most of the kids were all hanging out and skating together until pretty late. In fact, there's even a reference to Josh Burrows being there at some point that night. And there's a ton of witnesses. So basically every teenager in this group almost was there at some point that night hanging together. We also know that like Jake almost certainly went to sleep at his dad's house that night because they had court. So on Tuesday, Jake and Ray had court in Tracy for the dine and dash they'd gotten caught for. Jake's dad drives them at 4 a.m. that morning when he's going into work and drops them off in Tracy. They go to court. The judge is like, just pay the fine. It's all cool. Like, no big deal. Just pay the fine off and come back with the money. They head back, get back to Manteca, skate around some more, end up at Fuji again, and crash night at his place. Wednesday, that's the day that Jake goes and gets his mohawk cut and ends up hanging out in a few places that night. But we do know because of the black mohawk, it has to be Wednesday night, that he was hanging out with a guy named Vince Olson over at their friend Tanya's house. And then Thursday day, it's more the usual skating around. Jake goes back to the hair salon to get his hair dyed. This is the night that Prosecutor Schultz says that Jake goes to hang with Ty, and they have that whole weird thing where they find a random 13-year-old girl and molest her, which definitely didn't happen. I think in reality, there's two friends of Jake's that mentioned that a night that he was crashing with them. I think it's almost certainly that night. It's hard to verify this. And also the friend is dead, so we can't talk to him. But that's also the night before that. That's also the night that Jake is at the KFC and reports Renee missing. Then we have Friday. And after this point, Jake actually has a pretty ironclad alibi. We know where he was because Friday night, there's a big party at Bucktooth Billiards, this old billiards place on Yosemite. And he's seen there till late. The next day, he's confirmed with friends around town. That night, he's partying at Library Park with a bunch of people. So that's the rough timeline of what we know. And trying to find a day that the Home Depot party could have happened just doesn't work. Like, there's always something. For every night, there's a reason it couldn't have happened then.
Right, and the fact that nobody else remembers there being a party.
And that as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's such a large window, you know, in theory, where the prosecution is on this crime could have happened. And as you're pointing out here, you take the party aside, which there's no evidence of happening. There's no other window of opportunity for it to have happened either.
Yeah, he's just not with Renee during that time period.
So what we know for sure, I think we can be very confident, is saying that Renee and Jake were not together at any point after Monday morning. But what we don't know, what answer we don't have, is where was Renee?
Or also exactly when she died.
Or that. This episode, we also learned the name of the serial sex offender that was mentioned in an anonymous comment on the website about the ghost sightings at Home Depot. Turned out that figuring out his name was the easy part of all this. But Jared Daniel Conway is the man that the comment was about. He is currently in prison, serving minimum 25 years for the abduction with intent to rape of a 14-year-old girl, not eligible for parole until 2033.
And it was his third strike in California.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Barrett, when is he eligible for parole?
2033. It's not saying he's going to get it then, but like theoretically he could. Like, I hope he wouldn't get it then. And in this episode, what you heard was sort of the first things we learned about him once we had his name, the court files, what the record from Modesto showed. And at that point, we still didn't know if this could have anything to do with anything. And what we were going in looking for was just to figure out, like, is there even a reason to entertain this idea? And I think we basically realized after that trip to Modesto, Jacinda, that, I mean, yeah, theoretically, yeah, this guy could be a suspect.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities, I guess you would call them similarities, between the three cases we know about in California and Renee's case, you know, the women described being choked. I don't know. We went in not knowing what to expect. And when we came out, we thought, okay, there's more here that we need to do further digging on.
Yeah.
It's unsettling and, you know, catches your attention even more when someone's posting on a website.
Yeah. Finding Conway was the easy part though. What we needed to find was whoever left that comment. But the fact that someone theoretically could be involved is very different from saying that there are affirmative reasons to think they were involved. And from the court file, there's nothing to say that, like, oh, yes, absolutely, Conway was around Renee at this time or knew Renee or saw her. We didn't have that. We knew someone out there in the universe had posted that comment and believed that he did have reason to be in her proximity. But from what we knew from the court files and what we could find online, we didn't know anything beyond that yet.
Yeah, and in the upcoming episodes, we'll talk more about him and where we are with that investigation.
And maybe even hear from him himself. Next week, episode 9 is actually about season 1 of Proof, and you'll hear from Josh Story and Lee Clark about what life has been like after being exonerated.
Yeah, the last 15 months have been up and down for Lee and Kane, and we spent a lot of time with them over the past year and a half, and it'll be good for everyone to hear from them themselves what they're up to and what life for them has been like after being exonerated.
You've been listening to Proof Sidebar, a podcast by Red Marble Media in association with Glass Box Media. Send us your questions and comments at proofcrimepod@gmail.com. Follow us everywhere with the handle @proofcrimepod and on our website, proofcrimepod.com. Regular episodes drop on Mondays, and you can find sidebars on Thursdays. Thanks so much for listening.